This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 138, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. You can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. In this episode, I have two guests. In the first half, I talk to Chris Albeck about his book, Saucers, Tracing the Origins of Disc-Shaped UFOs. In the second half of the episode, I'm talking to Colette Lane about her book, Northern Lights, True Stories of UFO Sightings, Paranormal Activity, and Psychic Relationships. So on to the first half, where I'm talking to Chris Albeck. Now, Chris is a student of language and folklore, and he has helped compile the largest collection of pre-1947 UFO cases in the world. He has spoken on his research in many articles and on public radio. In 2008, he was awarded a prize for his contributions to the field by the Spanish organization Fundación Animalia. Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Saucers, Tracing the Origins of Disc-Shaped UFOs. And you have something you've organized called the Magonia Exchange. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so around the year 2003, I realized that so many of us researchers have piles of documents and magazines, articles, cuttings, other things at home, and that the internet finally would give us a way to share what we've all squirreled away over the years. So I decided it would be a nice idea to create an online archival project in which researchers could simply exchange what they have with what other people had. Because over the years, many ufologists have got to a stage in their lives where they drop out of the field. Then sometimes they die, for example, and everything they once had gets lost or is thrown away by their descendants or their widows. So it just seemed like a good idea to help preserve this information for future generations. And since 2003, we've managed to archive around 60,000 items, mainly about UFOs through history up until the year 1947. But also on other Fortean topics, such as strange animal rains or ghostly apparitions and so on. So it's been quite a successful 21 years of it. And many of our members who we have members in about 10 different countries have used this information to go on to make their own books, conferences, documentaries and so on.
And you've called it the Magonia Exchange, but where'd you get that word from, Magonia?
Yeah, well, the word Magonia is a word that Jacques Vallée used to describe this surreal realm, possibly in the sky, from which either alien visitors or folkloric beings came to visit the Earth. It's a word that comes from ancient French folklore, in fact, the idea that strange flying ships could come to visit us, well, according to the legends, even steal our crops and things like that. And it was said that they came from a mysterious world called Magonia. That's why his first book was called Passport to Magonia. And another book that I co-authored with a guy called Martin Schoff a few years ago was called Return to Magonia. So Magonia, in a sense, represents the world of folklore entities, particularly those that correspond with UFO entities.
And do you think there's, some kind of a link between folklore and UFOs? That kind of idea that hundreds of years ago, what people saw, they didn't know how to interpret it, and they did actually see something. And nowadays, if we saw it, we'd say it was a UFO.
Yeah, that's what I used to think until I really got deep into it. The fact is that since the 1950s and 60s, people have linked folklore, fairies and demons and spirits and so on, with ufology, because they seem to be manifestations of a very similar set of phenomena. Lights in the sky, mysterious entities, sometimes abductions and so on. And I believed that, and that was all until the beginning of the 2000s, when I realized that if you go back 300 years or more, you can find stories and beliefs about visiting extraterrestrials. That is to say, our ancestors didn't interpret everything as ghosts and goblins. They also understood that perhaps extraterrestrials from other planets or the sun or the moon were also coming to Earth to visit us. And that means that there's been an unbroken tradition of belief in extraterrestrial visitation over the last 300 years at least, which is why I published a book called Alien Artifacts in 2022, which is only volume one of a four-volume series, which shows how this idea that aliens often visit Earth and were even possibly our ancestors, is hundreds of years old.
Do you talk about, is it the Dogon tribe? Is that a genuine thing? I think they knew that there was a binary star system in our sky before us astronomers did. Is that right?
It's right that it's part of modern UFO folklore, but in reality, the Dogon thing, which was first published by Robert K.G. Temple in the 1970s in a book called The Sirius Mystery. He said that it seemed that the mythology of the Dogon tribe of Mali in Africa sort of represented modern advanced astronomical knowledge, and that they had knowledge about the rings of Saturn and star systems that they shouldn't really have. Unfortunately, that's been disproved over the years, and we know that the Dogon, on the one hand, probably never had these myths at all. They were invented a few decades earlier by overzealous French anthropologists. And apart from that, many of their supposedly advanced ideas were actually wrong. So no, the Dogons are a red herring here. Now, if you go back to, for example, 1823, that's when you find the first ever book published that suggested that our ancestors had come from a planet in our solar system that was destroyed and became the asteroids. So you could say that the ancient aliens hypothesis is 201 years old. Throughout the 19th century, people kept going back to the same idea. Maybe human civilization had originated as a consequence of aliens visiting the Earth, or possibly even part of an experiment by some extraterrestrial civilization. So it's a very, very old idea. And then you go back even further, a century or two, and you find very similar thoughts about how possibly Adam and Eve had come from other planets, about how certain communities living in South America or Africa whose existence couldn't be explained by the people who explored the jungles there. They said that maybe they had also come from the sky as extraterrestrials. It's a very old idea.
And that book you mentioned from 1823, that's not a work of fiction, is it? That's a genuine kind of hypothesis, so to speak?
That's right, yeah. It's if anyone wants to know more about it, they can pick up a copy of my book, Alien Artifacts, which is on Amazon. But in any case, they don't have to. The fact is that in 1823, a man called François Chabrier realized that he was finding a lot of giant rocks on his business trips to Germany, just scattered around the fields in such a way that didn't seem natural to him. So he reached the conclusion that maybe these were pieces of a planet that had exploded in the solar system. He wasn't sure how, but it was a very old idea that the asteroids had originally been some kind of planet that disappeared. And he put two and two together, and he thought, well, maybe if a planet exploded, remnants of that planet fell to Earth, and that way he tied together pyramids and Easter Island and a lot of other topics, which would become popular again over 100 years later.
You've written this book that's about sources and tracing the origins of sources. So why write a book on this specific subject? Why is this important?
Well, when I realized, okay, so in the year 2010, I published a book with Jacques Vallée called Wonders in the Sky. And we spent 3 years going through every historical case that we could find, every historical UFO case published in UFO books and in Roman chronicles and so on. And we realized that about 1% of those UFOs were disc-shaped, which seems to conflict with the later idea that flying saucers were, of course, round and flat. It seemed very strange that of the thousands of stories that you can find through history, practically none of them are ever about saucepan lid shaped objects. So this made me think that it was very likely that the idea of flying saucers started in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold's sighting. So I tried desperately for several years to find examples of flying saucers from before 1947, but I couldn't. And then I looked into the origins of the term flying saucer itself, and I reached some pretty surprising conclusions.
Because when Kenneth Arnold saw what he saw, even he didn't say they were discs, did he? He said they were kind of crescent-shaped.
Yeah, so his version of the UFOs that he saw changed over time, but in the initial interview that he gave with journalists in Pendleton, he didn't say that they were saucer-shaped or disc-shaped. The word that he actually uses, the only word that he used to describe the shape, was bat-shaped, like a bat in the sense of the animal. So that stands out as an anomaly because how did we get from bats to flying saucers?
And you also say in the book that that phrase, that term, flying saucers, came from somewhere else entirely a few decades before.
Yeah, that's right, because in the 19th century, around the year 1880, the most important national sport in America was trap shooting. And when they realized that it didn't make very good ecological sense to kill live birds, it was forbidden by law. So they had to move on to shooting at other kinds of objects. They initially invented little balls made of glass that would explode on impact if you shot them. But that was problematic because then the countryside would be full of shards of dangerous glass. So what happened was that a man called George Ligowski, he decided that maybe we could make discs, sort of small clay discs, which could be catapulted into the air and which gunners could shoot at. And because they're made of clay, it wouldn't pollute the environment and it wouldn't cause any ecological problems. And so that's exactly what he did. So around the year 1880, he designed the discs plus the trap. The trap is like a mechanical thing that catapults discs into the sky. And it became famous and very successful very quickly. And people called it the flying saucer, among other words. We also say clay pigeons. But because people began using the term flying saucer, if you look for flying saucer in the historical press, that is from 1880 to 1947, you only ever find it, but in incredible abundance, related to the sport of trap shooting. So when we get to 1947, probably around 400,000 people, because it was a very important sport, had already become acquainted with the expression flying saucer. So it after Kenneth Arnold's sighting, in which he did say that the objects were saucer-like, people just immediately associated what he saw with flying saucers, that is to say, small clay discs. And that's basically how the myth of flying saucers was born. He only used the expression saucer-like to express flatness, because it was very common at the time to say as flat as a saucer, in the same way that today we say as flat as a pancake.
And also they were kind of skipping around, weren't they, these crafty saucer, almost like saucer would bounce off the water if you were trying to skim it.
Right, yes. So because these objects moved, they sort of oscillated through the air, and because in trap shooting, it was common to talk about these clay discs as if they were also waving up and down as they moved. Not always. It depended on how they were shot. It was a very easy association to make. His objects with the flying discs in trap shooting.
So when it became sort of a headline about this guy seeing flying saucers then, was it like journalists trying to come up with a snappy title rather than anything Kenneth Arnold said?
That's exactly what happened, yeah. Because Kenneth Arnold didn't use the expression flying saucer himself, because the first journalists he spoke to also didn't use the expression flying saucer, but Arnold hadn't spoken to anybody else, what happened was that journalists all around North America independently came up with the joke that he'd seen flying saucers, that is to say, clay pigeons. So the question of who invented the term flying saucer is answered by saying a lot of people at the same time. It was basically just a joke. Also, we have to remember that the military had been using flying saucers, that is the small discs, for several years up to 1947. And if you look at the press of the 1940s, just 3 years before Kenneth Arnold's sighting, the military was using the expression flying saucer, which they used to train their gunmen by catapulting these things into the sky. A curious thing is that the man most associated with the military training exercise was a guy called Henry Arnold, and he appeared in newspapers talking about flying saucers being used as a military exercise for their gunners. And then 3 years later, it was a Kenneth Arnold who became associated with flying saucers. So in the space of 3 years, it went from one Arnold to another, speaking about flying saucers. And you can see that that people have very short memories, because nobody made that connection at the time. This is only something that you can do these days when you look back at the press.
So that phrase kind of came to be locked in. Flying saucer was also meant UFO in a way. But at the same time, as reports came in, there was lots and lots of people saying they saw UFOs or flying saucers. It was a very small percentage were actually saucer-shaped.
Yeah, that's true, because the word flying saucer itself, I mean, people are very good at separating expressions from their actual meanings. I remember years ago, I don't know what TV program it was, they went around the streets asking people what they thought Rice Krispies were made from, and how breakfast cereal. And so many people said, I don't know, maybe flour? but of course, the clue is in the name. They're made of rice. That's why it's called Rice Krispies. Or, for example, if you compare it to black boxes, which are used in airplanes, they're not black. They're actually orange. It's just because linguistically, what we do when we hear a particular term, we don't visualize it as what that term means literally. So for a long time, people saw UFOs, which were cube-shaped, hexagonal-shaped, cigar-shaped, and they were using the expression flying saucer to describe all of that. And of course, over time, what that does is that people will associate UFOs of any kind with the saucers and saucer-shaped. And then, of course, what happens is that children will start drawing flying saucers, or that is to say UFOs or spaceships. They'll start drawing spaceships as circular, flat objects, partly also because children do take the term more literally. I remember an experiment that my friend David Clark, the British UFO, or the British UFO researcher, did last year. He asked the audience to draw whatever they thought a UFO would look like, and practically everyone drew a disc. And of course, that's exactly what they don't look like normally in the modern world.
And I suppose that idea of it being a saucer, if somebody does report seeing them a lot, it could almost be thought, well, he's hoaxing it because they're not actually around that much. And it also reminds me of, you know, like George Adamski and his pictures.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in my book, I show how George Adamski's flying saucer was just a normal lantern that had been the people were using those days. It was like an oil lamp, and he'd just taken the lid off the top and modified a few things underneath, and voila, that's how we have his flying saucer photos. But yeah, this is it. I mean, people just associated UFOs with flying saucers from the beginning, and but if you look at the statistics, you discover that in the modern world, practically all UFOs are either perfectly round, or they are cigar shaped, triangular. Discs are one of the least common shapes, and it's been like that for about 30 years at least. It doesn't matter what UFO database you consult, you would always find that result. Discs are definitely on the way out. I would say that they stopped being a part of ufology many years ago.
So when Kenneth Arnold had that sighting over the mountains, a huge amount of publicity, but he says that's not the only sighting he had. It seemed almost like he was a flying saucer magnet, so to speak. Was it 8 different times he said he saw them?
Yeah, depending on the report that you read, either he saw UFOs 11 times, 8 times. It all started, in 1950. It said that Arnold had seen UFOs 3 times since he noticed the first ones, which would mean probably 4 or 5 times. Then by 1952, the press said that Arnold claimed to have seen 11. Or, for example, in June 1977, he said that he'd seen UFOs 7 times in all. So, yeah, he had several sightings. I think that once you've had one UFO sighting and you get quite excited about it, your mind becomes open to the possibility of seeing them again. So whether he saw a genuine UFO or not in 1947, he began interpreting anything he couldn't see or he couldn't understand in the sky, strange lights or whatever, as part of the same phenomenon.
And didn't he say that he thought with that initial sighting that the craft were actually alive?
Yeah, from around 1950, 1952 onwards, he had the idea that flying saucers were actually creatures. They were living organisms. And it's interesting because it means that he couldn't believe that when people said that they had encountered the pilots of a UFO, he found that very difficult to believe because he thought, well, how could you encounter aliens driving one if they're not drivable? They must be living organisms. Well, I was actually speaking to Kenneth Arnold's daughter, Kim, and his granddaughter too, Chanel, and they told me about Kenneth Arnold's psychic encounters with flying saucers, because he believed that sometimes these objects try to communicate with him telepathically. So, of course, if you're dealing with an object in the sky and the object itself seems to be trying to communicate with you, the logical conclusion is that that object is an alien organism of some kind. And yeah, that's the reason he thought that they were organic instead of nuts and bolts craft.
Well, it's interesting that he might have said that so many years ago when, over the last recent decades, people have been talking about abductions and how the Greys will always communicate with them telepathically and the other ETs, and Arnold saying that was happening to him before then. It's not like he thought he heard it from abductees and thought, oh, that's a good idea, I'll put that in as well.
Well, the idea of telepathy in UFO encounters or alien encounters is even longer than that. You can find it in pulp fiction, magazines and comics of the 1920s and 1930s. And you can probably take it back as far as 1848, when, as I detail in my other book, Alien Artifacts, you find a story about a UFO landing. The occupant comes out and starts to touch the witness's forehead and begins to read the witness's thoughts and to learn his language, which was German. And so the idea of thought transference has a very, very old, a very long history. But then you go back to Emanuel Swedenborg in the 18th century, who also said that he had encounters with aliens and visited other planets and so on. He published this in a book in 1758 called Other Earths in This Universe. And he said that the people of Mercury, who always dressed in blue, would read his thoughts and could just look through his mind as if it were a library of events. So even going back to the 18th century, you find the idea of telepathy occurring a lot in UFO encounter cases.
Okay, and now on to the second part of the episode. This is where I talk to Colette Lane about her book, Northern Lights, True Stories of UFO Sightings, Paranormal Activity, and Psychic Relationships. Colette has always been attuned to the supernatural and has experienced psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial activity. She recalls UFO experiences from her childhood in the early 60s and 70s. Hi, Colette. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Northern Lights, True Stories of UFO Sightings, Paranormal Activity, and Psychic Relationships. So this goes right back into your childhood, doesn't it? Can you remember what was the first thing that happened?
It was back in the 90s. A lot of things, a lot of events were happening. And I started getting sick right around that time. And I had taken some medicine for sleep because I wasn't sleeping, a lot of pain. And I went into like a deep sleep, and it was like I had a near-death experience where I had literally gone through a tunnel of light and came up to this place that was, and it was very peaceful. And it was like I didn't want to leave, and it was like a council of these beings that were all clothed and bathed in this golden light. And they were asking me if I wanted to stay or if I wanted to go. And I told them, I need to go back for my daughter and I need to finish my music. I said, I think those are the responsibilities that I need to do still on Earth. So they told me at that point that it wouldn't be easy, but they would send me back. And then I came back through. But in that process, something happened where I had regained memories of childhood memories from when I was really sick as a child. And that was about when I was about 4 or 5. There was weird experiences too. I just were getting back pieces of it. But in this awareness that I was getting, and it came in really fast, was where I was on a table in a ship with the grays. And this is a hard part for me to talk about, but it was like I was abducted and they were doing tests. And I remember screaming and nothing coming out. And I was so scared and terrified. And they kept doing these probes and they had put something up into my nasal cavity, and I could hear the cartilage break, and I was screaming. And then they put something in my eardrum, and it sounded like it punctured it. And I kept screaming, and I was telling, and it's the grace, and I kept telling them, "You're hurting me." And they were saying, "No, we're not, you're not hurting." And I said, "Yeah." And I kept screaming, but nothing would come out of my mouth. And I was screaming as loud as I could. Well, okay, that was the one experience of that it was a traumatic experience. Then a next segment of a recall that I had was, again, I was sitting upright on a table, and it was back at the childhood stage, about 4 or 5. And I remember a big, tall being. He was creamy white, almost a pinkish. His eyes weren't quite as big as the grays, and they were much smaller. And this taller being was the guy, this person in charge of the grays. He was looking. We didn't speak with our mouths, but we talked inside our heads, like telepathy. And I remember reaching out, and he was touching my fingertips. They used to do at the hospital, they would have to keep doing a blood test where they'd prick your finger. And I used to hate that. I would scream because it hurt so bad, and they had to do it so many times. I was in the hospital for a good while. And it knew, this being knew what I had gone through, and we were touching our fingertips together. And it was like we made that connection, and it came back. And then I remember looking down at the gray, and I reached out to touch his nose, because his nose looked so different from ours. And it pushed my hand away, because I guess I was kind of smothering it a little. In that, when I remember the ship, there was some kind of like a board, a screen, and it had like a star map. And it had different areas. And then the last physical encounter was when, again, I was asleep, but I started to wake up. And I wasn't quite awake. You're like right in between being asleep and awake. And I remember something pinching, poking me in my neck. And I had turned over, and it was a gray with a long tube-like object, like an injector. And it had just put something into the left side of my neck. Either it put something in or it took something out. And then I remember just turning over and falling back to sleep again. But the next morning when I got up, you know, it was sore. And I looked in the mirror, and the diagram that I sent you that has the circle with the little dots perfectly in the middle, that's what was on there. So I said, okay, that was definitely not a dream. And that was in the 90s when that event happened. That was the last physical one that I was partially conscious of. That was back in the 90s. A few years later, I had cervical surgery, and there's a scar. It's a long scar, and it's right underneath where they had jabbed me with that. So there's a line that runs directly underneath it, and that's from the surgery, because they have to go in from behind the throat to get into the spine to put hardware in. And it's right, that surgical scar came afterwards, but that big round one is still there. It still hurts. Sometimes it gets worse than others, but it'll start stinging and it itches, and it's still round. But you can't see those little dots, not like when it was fresh. And I remember looking at the x-rays. I did not see an object in there, because they had to do the MRIs before the surgery. So they didn't put like a chip or anything in there. So either they had to put some kind of, I don't know what, something in there that's not physically like a chip, or they were extracting something from me. It has to be one or the other. But that was the last physical contact that I had with them. Also, back in the late 70s, very early 80s, I had injured my hand at work, and they went in and did an x-ray. When we got the x-ray back, the doctor was saying, well, it doesn't look like he broken anything. And I said, there's a black dot between my thumb and my index finger, right in that soft part of your skin. And it was like a black looking, almost like a metallic piece. I said, well, what is that? And he says, well, I don't know. He goes, is it hurting you? I said, no. He said, then don't worry about it. He says, you're clear. You can go back to work on light duty. That was another thing, was that other implant. And then recently, just this last year, I was lucky enough to find some of the UFO documentaries. And a guy had the same thing, and it was in the same place. And the guy, they had it extracted. They ran it through some tests on this guy, but they couldn't identify the material. So I'm thinking it's still there on the right hand. I haven't had it x-rayed since then, but it's probably implant. I probably have one up in my sinus cavity as well, maybe something behind the ear, because I remember hearing the cartilage break during the abduction. So it was definitely, but when I got this last one, that jab, whatever he was putting in, that gray was a long cylinder tube, and it made an impression, and it was too perfect to be an inset bite. It was just, it looked like some kind of an injector metal object that he pushed in, and it stung. That's what startled me. That's what woke me up for a second. And I pushed his hand away, and then I fell back to sleep. Back in the late 60s, my sister and I lived upstairs in a second-story apartment window. And you could see the mountains in Upland, and there's San Bernardino Mountains, and Mount Baldy was there. And we were watching TV that night. I believe it was the Sunday night. My mom was cooking. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and then I called my sister, and there were these huge black triangle-looking craft, and they had solid blue neon green lights, more blue than green, and they were going very slowly. It had to be about maybe 4 or 5, and they were all going across the foothills very, very slow, and we just kept looking because we'd never seen anything like that before, and we didn't have anything here on the earth like that at that time that I had seen. The fact that it never, they didn't fall, and they were going so slow, and we just looked dumbfounded at each other, and we tried to get our mom to come and look, but she didn't waste any time. She says, no, I'm busy cooking dinner, you know, never mind. But the next day after school, I had come home, and I remember finding, grabbing the newspaper down at the bottom of the stairs, going inside the apartment, sitting down, get my cereal, you know, after school. I opened the newspaper, and it was on the front page, and it said strange lights over Mount Baldy, something similar. And somebody had captured a picture of them. The area that was the neon, the blue that went all the way around the sides showed up as a red color. And there was reports about the sighting. And it was, I mean, it was a good picture, even though it was in black and white. And it was red around the edges. You could clearly see that something's there. So years later, this was in the 90s, I went into the archives of the library. I went through everything, Simon, everything, and I couldn't find anything on it. I found the other articles that were similar to it, but not the one that had that photo, because it was on the front page. And so then I wrote to see if it was declassified or something. And they said they had no record of it at all. I'm thinking that they kept it, you know, how the government is. Also, during that time at the condos, when I had the abduction recalls, there was this light, Simon. And it came from outside, but it flashed inside, and it was so intense and bright. It was like taking if you remember the old Kodak flashes that were on the Kodak cameras, and when you took them, it would just blind you because the flash was so bright. That's what was happening, but it was coming from above, and it was coming from outside, but it would light up the whole condo inside, and it was just like a second, like flashes. That happened a couple of times. Then it happened on the way during the same time line. I was on an airplane going to Las Vegas, and the same thing, a light flashed from above and outside and went into the airplane. And the other people were just going, what was that? They were like looking around, what was that? You know, but I had seen it before. So I just, you know, I didn't pay any attention to it. It's like, well, they see it too. I don't know. And the only thing I could think of was either it was government, maybe something technology from a satellite, or it was something connected to the extraterrestrials. But I did make some sketches. And now one of the creatures that is in this, on the sketches, somebody had accessed my place back in the 90s at the condos. And I was going back through some old photos and I saw this creature, and it looked like a lizard, and it was short. It wasn't tall, and it was black. It had really red eyes, and it looked like a kind of like a lizard. And I said, somebody's like messing with me. You know, they're messing with my head. They Photoshop something in or something. But around that time, and I never saw this like creature physically. It was in that photograph that I thought was fake. There was a smell. With it was like a wet, musky river smell, like musky. And very strong odor. And I kept smelling that in the condos, and I didn't know. I didn't make the association, but it showed up just about that time that whoever accessed those photos had done something. And I showed it to somebody else, and they said, oh no, it's just a reflection. There's nothing there. So I just tossed them because I thought, oh, somebody's just messing with me. My sister had passed away. This was years ago. Of course, my mom was really upset. So I stayed with her that night. That night, I had a vision of my sister. I woke up and Simon, she was clearly visible. And I saw her. She was in this long, beautiful gown. And she had like flowers in her hand. And she had this serious look on her face, and she was just standing there. And I kept trying to wake my mom up, and I couldn't wake her up. I looked back and she was still standing there, and I got so scared. I put my head under the pillow. When I looked back up, she was gone. But that was her way of coming back to tell me goodbye, that she loved me, to tell me goodbye. And then I talk about when I was a child, how I was attracted to praying mantises, and it had something to do with their eyes. And I was still a kid then. And I used to collect them and put them in jars, poke little holes in them for air for them, put little leaves. But I was fascinated by them. When the book got released, this past year, just in December, January, I guess is when it came out. I was sitting again on the porch. This is a different house. And I was sitting on the porch and I kept looking up at this one spot and it was blue sky. And I don't know why. Sometimes I'm just drawn to a section of the sky for some reason and I don't know why. And I was looking at it and all of a sudden I caught a glimpse of a disc, a silver metal disc shape, just for an instant. And it like tilted, like it kind of gave me a wink and it became visible. And then it went. And it was like, okay, this is, they know that was their way of saying, well done, you got the book out, right? It was like, I felt like they were giving me a wink, like acknowledging, knowing that what I was trying to do. And then on the same porch area, there was this green mantis. It was up with the eyes, but only this one was smaller. And it was on the windowsill. And it stayed there for the longest time. And it brought back the memories of when I was a child again. So I don't know what the extraterrestrial connection is to it. Maybe it's the eyes or there, you know, but there was some kind of connection. But I thought, oh my gosh, it was like another kind of a validation. And it was right after the book got published. It was like, yeah, here we go, right? So there's lots of little validations that people get all the time, and they just don't know it until it clicks. That's why you've got to trust your instincts. You know, when you get a gut feeling, trust it and trust the first thing. When you get that, when it comes to you, take it right from the start, and it comes in fast. And those are the accurate ones, because when you get that gut feeling and instinct, a flash, and you don't listen to it, it always comes back and bites you for some reason. It's like, it's that, man, I knew I should have done something about that, or I knew I should have taken care of that. And it's that, I knew I should have, but you didn't act on it. So that's another important thing that I've learned, to be more in tune with my instincts and my sensitivity. I don't like noise. I'm constantly in a quiet environment, and it seems to help me to connect, to make the psychic connections that I do make. So, and I wrote a list like of how to help you connect that way. I hope it helps.
We're almost run out of time.
Right.
And it's been great hearing everything. The book's called Northern Lights, True Stories of UFO Sightings, Paranormal Activity and Psychic Relationships. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Oh, yes, they can get that online. It's Newman Publishing, and that puts it out. But I really appreciate, I hope the main message is to bring awareness to people out there, to let you know that, hey, you're not crazy. You know, there are extraterrestrials out there, and there's different species. These are the ones that I can talk about, the ones that I've had experience with. But there's others. I'm sure other people have had other experiences, but don't think you're crazy. Don't brush it off. Eventually, I think we'll know more. The government will release more in time. But right now, I think they're just trying to keep everything calm as far as that goes, if you get my drift.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, so in the first half of this episode, I talked to Chris Albeck about his book, Sources: Tracing the Origins of Disc-Shaped UFOs, And in the second half, I talked to Colette Lane about her book, Northern Lights, True Stories of UFO Sightings, Paranormal Activity, and Psychic Relationships. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month, and in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. And my website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.